Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces distinguished people from Indiana, the U.S., and the world to WFIU listeners. I'm Owen Johnson. On this occasion, we welcome Andrew Nagorski, an award-winning foreign correspondent and now senior editor of Newsweek International. He's the author of the recently published book, The Greatest Battle, a story of the biggest battle of World War II, the Battle of Moscow in late 1941 and the first part of 1942. Andy, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You're almost a case study from a book by Stephen Hess about foreign correspondents, someone who has rich background in languages and family background overseas. It might be good to start with something about that family background.
All right. My parents grew up in Poland, and my father had recently almost completed his law studies when the war broke out. They had just gotten married, and he was called up into the Polish army. He fought in the September of 1939 when the Germans invaded Poland, and then shortly after the Soviet Union invaded from the east. After Poland fell and the German occupation began, Polish troops were told to surrender to the German authorities or to register with them, which you knew meant going into POW camps. He decided to defy that order, and he and one buddy decided to try to escape. They did. They managed to. Actually, several other ex-soldiers joined them. And like many soldiers who escaped, ended up at first in France, and then when France fell, was evacuated by the British to Britain. And these Polish units were regrouped in Britain, spent the war years in Britain and in England and Scotland, and then going into the continent after D-Day. After the war, since my grandfather had been fairly prominent in the Polish government in exile in London, which was of course an anti-communist government, realized there was no going back, decided to emigrate to the United States to apply for political asylum. My arrival delayed their departure a little bit, and so by the time when I came to the States with my parents, I was less than a year old in 1948. And we grew up at first in the States, and then my father eventually became a U.S. diplomat. So I grew up bouncing around the world the way I would soon bounce around the world as a foreign correspondent for Newsweek.
Your undergraduate studies were in history. Was it the family background that led you to history, or was there something else?
Well, I think the family background certainly was a very strong influence. I was always acutely aware of the fact, if not for the course of history and these events, I would have grown up, for instance, as a Pole instead of American. So history was not some abstraction to me. It has a direct impact on everybody's life, and certainly everyone in that part of the world felt it. I was also intrigued by political science. It just happened to be I took some courses in political science and history and English, and decided that I felt that the history department was the strongest department where at that time at Amherst College, where I was an undergraduate. So that's what I pursued.
But you pursued it only for a while. I get you did teach, right, after you left college or finished college?
Yes, I taught high school for 3 years. I had spent a couple of summers on teaching programs. I remember this was the late 60s, this is civil rights days. I spent one summer teaching in Mississippi, one summer teaching outside of New York, and enjoyed it. I just found that I liked it a lot. I taught for 3 years, but I also had a little bit of the journalistic bug in me. I'd worked for the school newspaper. My dad had also done some journalism. He had, towards the end of the war, he'd become a war correspondent for the Polish Army newspaper and continued to write quite a bit. So it was journalism was also something that I guess was – there was a seed there. And after a couple of years of teaching, I began to think, well, I'd like to try to see if I could break into journalism, and I began to plot in that direction.
What was the plotting like?
Well, the plotting was try to bang on doors and hope somebody's door will at least open to consider you. But it was tough. All I had were my college clips, and I was living near Boston at the time, teaching in a high school just outside of Boston. the Boston Globe, I couldn't get my foot in the door even for an interview. The Christian Science Monitor interviewed me, said that I was in consideration for a junior position. I didn't get it. And it was one of these things where somebody said, I know somebody at Newsweek. Why don't you talk to them? I went. In those days, they had a pretty flexible tryout program for inexperienced people like myself where they – if they thought there was some reason you might work out, they'd take you on from anywhere from 2 weeks to 6 months. And at the end of any week, they could say, you're hired or you're fired. So it was a very nerve-wracking time. They kept me hanging till the end of the 6 months. But at the end, I did manage to get a job, started working in New York, and then began the next plotting, which was to get abroad as a foreign correspondent, which is what I really wanted to do.
You're – biography or biographical information suggests you were in the New York – based out of the New York office for what, 4 or 5 years?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Almost five. Yeah.
And then – so how did you – Hong Kong was your first stop. How did you get there?
I expected that I'd be pointed more in the direction of Moscow or Central Europe because of my background and that was the area I felt I best prepared for. But I was making noises about going there, and I remember the first time there was an opening in Moscow. I'd only been at Newsweek 2 or 3 years, and I applied for it, and they said, "You're not ready." And of course, I was outraged. But now I see in retrospect, they were absolutely right. I wasn't ready. They knew that I was interested in going abroad, and as it happened, the first opening that came up when they felt maybe I'm ready was Hong Kong. It was a roving job all over Asia. And when they offered that to me, I just grabbed it. I figured, you know, it'll be an adventure. I'll see what happens. I was both terrified and elated.
Now, was that particularly difficult? Because I remember a Los Angeles Times correspondent in Warsaw once telling me that he had been in Moscow and had been in Poland and it was very easy to blend into the population. And in Asia, you have a whole different set of circumstances.
Yes, it is a whole different set of circumstances. And obviously, I didn't have the Asian languages. And your appearance is precisely that you're never – can be just a fly on the wall. Everyone knows you're an outsider there. So, I mean, I really enjoyed traveling around Asia. It was a fascinating time to be there. This was 1978 to 1980. So much was happening. We recognized China at the time. The whole boat people surge from Vietnam. There was the assassination of the president, Park Chung-hee, in South Korea, various forms of unrest there. There were a lot of really interesting stories and it was a great training ground. But ultimately, I did feel I wanted to I'd prefer to go to a place where I could get more deeply into the culture, the society, learn the languages. So I did once again start pitching for Moscow, and this time it worked.
Was it by chance that it happened about the same time as the Solidarity movement developed in Poland, or was that part of the plot?
I'm sure the KGB thought it was part of the plot. It was by chance, of course, but that the timing worked out that way. But that had an impact, I think, on my first stay in Moscow. Because I came to Moscow. My wife, by the way, is Polish. I spent a semester as an exchange student in Poland. And since I grew up speaking Polish at home, it was a really interesting time for me to go there, and I could immediately get into the society. And as it turned out, I met and married my wife there, and it was a busy semester. And so when we went to Moscow in 1981, after doing a crash course in Russian, because I did not have the Russian and I had to learn it, I think the fact that so much was going on in Poland meant that a lot of Russians we befriended would come and to talk to us about what was going on in Poland, to hear stories from Poland, because we went there a couple of times. My wife would get Polish newspapers and so forth. I remember there were Russians in our house even looking at Polish newspapers just to see what movies they were playing in Warsaw, because Warsaw was a much freer place compared to Moscow. And they were stunned that there was so much going on in Warsaw. of course, the Soviet authorities were bugging your apartments. They were monitoring you, and they knew this was going on, and I'm sure they were not pleased by it.
You were somewhat unusual, I think, among the crowd of Moscow correspondents because so many of them saw the events through the eyes of Moscow, through the leadership in Moscow. Not intentionally, I don't think, but you have this additional East European perspective. Did that color your reporting?
I'm sure it did. I'm sure it did, and I also took a special interest in talking to people about what was going on in Poland to try to get a sense, well, is this something that is has echoes here? I mean, the leadership was clearly alarmed by the events in Poland and by the possibility, even the tiniest possibility, that the seeds of dissent could be transferred to other parts of the Soviet Empire and to the heartland, to the Russian heartland. So I wanted to test that. So I would engage people in conversations every chance I could. And of course, since I knew the Polish situation pretty well from the inside, as you say, my natural instinct was to write from a perspective that was not a purely Moscow perspective by any means.
Reporting from the Soviet Union was always a challenge because of people hesitant to talk. Did you learn how to report there on the go or did you have some kind of warnings or trainings or whatever it is before you went?
Well, I mean, I guess the kind of training I had was simply, first of all, read up everybody on, about all those kinds of earlier experiences of correspondence and also to read up what Russians wrote about foreign reporters. Some of Andrei Amalrik, a famous Russian dissident, wrote an essay about foreign reporters and sort of the do's and don'ts. For instance, never sign anything that the KGB or the CIA or the police asks you to sign, these so-called protocols if they detain you. And that happened to me several times. And they'll threaten you and they'll say you have to sign. And you say no. And eventually they bring in two so-called witnesses, anybody off the street, and say, you saw this guy do whatever it was he was supposed to have done, and they'll sign. But that's – you're in a much better position if they signed rather than you signed. Also, when I was studying Russian, my wife and I were studying Russian in Monterey, California. There's a very famous Defense Language Institute there, but there's also the private school, the Monterey Institute of International Affairs, which was set up – take advantage of the fact that there were so many Russians in the area, Russian instructors, and to set up private programs. And we did this very intensive Russian course. But we also socialized with many of the Russian exiles there. And many of them had family members still back or friends back in Russia. And they would talk about the whole business of how you can contact people, you know, what's the protocol is, how you try not to jeopardize them because the biggest fear is always not to jeopardize your sources. They were taking much bigger risks than you were. But they also gave us leads, introductions, and sort of then my philosophy was I tried to contact as many people who I had contacts for when I got there. And some of them were interested in meeting a foreign correspondent. Others said, thank you very much, but, you know, it's, you know, in effect, it's too dangerous. And I respected that.
One of the criticisms of some of the reporting from Moscow was that the Western journalists tended to operate to some degree as a pack. They sort of exchanged ideas, exchanged stories. Did you have to deal with that?
Well, of course you operated there was a camaraderie among correspondents there that you normally don't have. You know, we are highly competitive people for the most part. But in Moscow, because there was a sense of that you could – they could play all sorts of games with you, you did – work with other correspondents and you exchanged information. For instance, a certain amount. I mean not everything, but let me give you a specific example. I got to know a couple of young people who decided to organize what they called the first independent peace group in Moscow. This was at the time when there was a big peace movement in Western Europe opposing the deployment of American missiles in Western Europe. Well, they said, okay, we'll organize our own peace group, which was against the deployment of both American missiles and Soviet missiles, which of course was seen as an act of dissent. And so they wanted to organize a press conference. And since they knew me, they said, can you pass along word to other correspondents about this press conference? Because every contact is dangerous for us. So you can do it more easily you know, I can just talk to people outside in the courtyard or something and tell them it's happening. I did. So in that sense, when we traveled, you'd often try to travel with a colleague from an organization that say I'd travel with a colleague, say from the Chicago Tribune or from the LA Times, something that was not a direct competitor to Newsweek, for the simple reason that if something happened, if there was some sort of provocation, they try to claim that, for instance, I had done something outrageous, I would have a witness about what really happened. It wouldn't be simply my word against whoever's. So you did that sort of thing. In terms of reporting stories, I think the PAC journalism that you're talking about is simply following often the lead of kind of TASS, the official news agency, taking the story of the day and doing not much more beyond that. There was, unfortunately, a fair amount of that passivity too. That was the easiest way to just sort of service your newspaper or your magazine or your wire service. There was definitely a divide between those correspondents who really tried to break out of that and do original reporting, which could get you in trouble.
Now, another challenge in Moscow at the time, what was the proper journalist relationship with the U.S. Embassy, because people in the embassy had information that would be useful to reporters.
Yeah.
Did you find that a challenge?
You know, I felt in Asia the same thing. There were times, you know, there were people in the embassy who were covering certain aspects. Of course, there are far more people in the embassy than us reporters. So there would be people who would specialize in certain areas, who would travel certain areas. And yes, you know, we would talk to these people. They would also talk to us. I didn't feel that this was compromising anything. They were one source among many. But on certain issues, say, for instance, military issues, that sort of thing, or you know, when this was a very tense time and there were rumors that the Soviet Union might invade Poland to crush Solidarity. You know, they had obviously intelligence that I had no access to, and if I could get anything out of them, I would.
When you were in the Soviet Union, how much did you have an opportunity to travel outside of Moscow? Because that was another criticism of many reporters, that they didn't see what was happening in the other republics.
Yeah. I made a determined effort to travel as much as I could, and that was one of the reasons, I think, why I ultimately got expelled. In theory, there had been an earlier period where you had to ask for permission before the so-called Helsinki Accords of 1979, which sort of set new standards. You had to ask permission every time you left Moscow. After that, the procedure was changed somewhat, whereby you had to inform the Soviet Foreign Ministry where you were going, when you were going, how you were going. But unless they said you can't go, you in theory could go. And they didn't like to refuse you outright too often, because that meant that the State Department would retaliate against Soviet correspondents in the United States and also not allow them to travel, say, from Washington to Indiana. But if you started traveling a lot, they got annoyed. And the surveillance, say, by the KGB became very overt. They could be covert when they wanted to be. They were very professional if they wanted to be. But when they started following you openly, these young guys usually in leather jackets, you know, very, very thuggish looking guys, you knew the message was to you they were angry, and they were also sending, more importantly, a message to everyone you were trying to talk to. This is a dangerous guy. Don't talk to this person. So that would happen. When I traveled by car, there were occasions where my tires were slashed in a small village, and a policeman knocks on the door to the guy I'm talking to and says, "Oh, is this your Volvo by any chance?" You know, as if it could be anybody else's Volvo.
But you had the telltale foreign correspondent license plate.
Right, and you have the telltale foreign correspondent's license plate. So, you know, they quickly tried to make it as difficult and unpleasant as possible. So, and a lot of correspondents, after a few such experiences, frankly, started traveling less. I just determined to ignore that and figured if I'm here, I've got to try to make the most of this experience.
Did you discuss these ideas with the editors back in New York? Weren't they perhaps afraid that they could lose you if you were thrown out?
I think everyone knew that in theory, if you pushed the limits, at some points you could be thrown out. Of course, nobody – you didn't want that. It was a great story. It was really – it was difficult, frustrating, but really exhilarating to try to get behind the sort of the lies and the secrecy of this society. I never felt any pressure from my editors to back off. And while they were, of course, in many ways disappointed when I was thrown out, they backed me to the hilt. And I have to say they were very good about it. You know, it just – my feeling was that if you start to play the game of trying to figure out what's going to please them or not please them, they've won. You're self-censoring yourself.
What triggered your expulsion?
I think it was cumulative, a number of stories, my travels in part, the kinds of stories I was doing on those travels. For instance, I went to Tajikistan on the border of Afghanistan and talked to young Muslims how they felt about the war in Afghanistan when the Soviets were fighting in Afghanistan, of course. Or to Lithuania and talk to people about how they felt about the solidarity movement across the border in Poland, or about food shortages in the provinces, and then about the political intrigue in Moscow. At the time, Leonid Brezhnev, the party leader, was dying. We had one cover story which clearly did not help my case in the sense that the cover said Brezhnev's final days and it had a cracking bust of Brezhnev on it. That was actually a choice of the New York art staff, not mine, but I think that also got them quite angry.
You wrote a book called Reluctant Farewell about your time there and your departure. Did you go there consciously thinking about a book because what Bob Kaiser of the Washington Post, Hedrick Smith of the New York Times had had them in the 1970s and it seemed fairly frequent?
Yes, there had been a lot of books about Moscow and about the Russian experience, and you know, as you mentioned, Smith and Kaiser did very good books at the time. I don't think I was yet consciously thinking about a book. It was sort of a thought. Sure, I mean, like any journalist, I thought at some point I'll write a book. Whether it'll be about my Moscow experience or something else, we'll see. I didn't feel, you know, at that point I was still too preoccupied about just doing my daily, weekly job for Newsweek to really seriously think about it. When I had done some article that an agent back in New York really liked, and he sent me a note and said, "If you ever think about doing a book, please contact me." And I sort of filed that letter away. And then when then I was expelled, then it occurred to me, say, well, I've got a lot of stories here that I'm not going to be able to really spin out. And my expulsion itself became a pretty big story, not just because it was me personally, because it was sort of symbolic of U.S.-Soviet relations at the time. And then I began seriously thinking about a book. But I hadn't gone in consciously with a game plan for a book, no.
The next place you wound up was Rome, and some listeners might think, well, this is obvious again. He has Polish background. There's a Polish pope. Did you use that as leverage?
Well, this was a little bit, you know, I talk about chance in history, and I think chance in your own history. A few days before I was expelled, I saw that our correspondent in Rome, Elaine Cialino, who's now with the New York Times, who was a good friend at the time, and was going off to do a one-year fellowship and that Rome would be vacant. And I thought, you know, the thought flitted through my mind, well, there must be, you know, all sorts of people lined up to grab that job, and just put it out of my mind. Then I was kicked out. And after we got through all the business of, you know, the procedures of actually leaving the country, I talked with my editors in New York and they started saying, well, we have to think about where you're going to go. Do you have any preferences? And I said, well, by any chance, is that Rome job still open? And they said, oh, yes, it is. And they said, would you want it even if it's for a year? Because Elaine has been promised that she can come back to that job. And I said, sure, a year in Rome doesn't sound bad. And so I went there. And in fact, Elaine did not come back. She decided to stay based in the States. And so I ended up in Rome for, I think, about 2.5 years. And, of course, that was a fascinating time because it was still early in John Paul's pontificate. I got to travel with the Pope all over the world. The fact that I spoke Polish, I could throw questions at him in Polish, was also an advantage. Even though he's an incredible linguist, he always, I felt, breathed a sigh of relief when he didn't have to switch to yet another language. So, you know, it was serendipity, but I just basically lucked out.
I guess the additional advantage, you had studied in Krakow and guess where the Pope came from.
That's right. That's right.
Your family was with you on all these travels?
Absolutely.
What kind of experience was that for them?
It was a great experience. My wife is a wonderful traveler. She loves traveling and really immerses herself in every place we went, quickly wants to learn about it. And we left. We had two kids when we left, two young kids. By the time we came back after traveling the world for almost 20 years, we had four. None of my kids certainly regretted it. And the fact I grew up that way because of my father's diplomatic career for a while. And obviously, I didn't feel it harmed me. In fact, I really appreciated it. And I think my kids did too. Of course, it's sometimes difficult to leave a place, but they plunged in very well. And of course, and each of them learned some languages based on where they were at what particular time in their lives. So, it was a very good experience for the whole family.
Let's take a break now and listen to some music. You've picked Roads to Moscow by Al Stewart from his album Past, Present, and Future. How did you come to know this music and what does it mean to you?
It's simply because my book is about Moscow. I didn't know this music when it first came out, and I never heard of it before I started working on the book. And in fact, my son-in-law pointed it out to me, and I listened to it, and it just the lyrics and everything are so apropos of the subject of my book that I just felt it was something that'd be fun to play.
They cross over the border the hour before dawn, moving in lines through the day. Most of our planes would have strayed on the ground where they lay, waiting for orders we held in the wood. Word from the front never came. By evening the sound of the gunfire was miles away. Softly we move through the shadow, slip away through the trees, crossing their lines in the mists and the fields, on our hands and our knees.
That was Roads to Moscow by Al Stewart, music chosen by our guest on Profiles today, Andrew Nagorski, the senior editor of Newsweek International. As a foreign correspondent, what story were you most proud of?
I would say maybe it's hard to say a single story, but I'd like to think that during that time I was serving both in Moscow and then later traveling around what was we then referred to as Eastern Europe, talking to people who were both in the openly dissident movements like Solidarity or Charter 77 in Czechoslovakia or the Democratic Opposition in Hungary, that I tried to really give some sense of what was happening below the surface of these societies. I think we look back and we see this fall of the Berlin Wall and it all sounds inevitable now. But believe me, in those days – that system looked very well entrenched, and even the most famous activists like Lech Wałęsa in Poland, Václav Havel in Prague and others had no sense that they were going to immediately topple the system. And in fact, Havel always had this saying, which I remember he told me the first time. I had one of the first times I met him when he was still under being closely watched by the police and in and out of prison. He said, you know, if you begin to calculate that your odds for success, you'll never do anything. And the courage of these people in trying to just stand up for the truth and say the truth in a society built on lies, if I was able to convey some of that and that this system was on these rotten foundations, and I can't claim to have predicted how fast it would come apart I was as startled by the speed of it when it began to collapse as anybody else. But I think if I was able to convey some of those undercurrents when many people were just assuming, you know, these are such isolated voices, they don't mean anything. I always felt instinctively that they meant something, although I, again, I feel that I also didn't quite get it all the way.
What was the story that was most difficult to report?
Well, some of the most difficult to report, of course, were those stories from the Soviet Union in the early days. Because when you're traveling and you're monitored and people are very hesitant to talk to you, or the people who talk to you are the ones who they sort of put out there to talk to you and tell you spin tales that you know are all based on at least half truths. Getting to say the stories of Communist Party privilege in this supposedly egalitarian society, you know that that's all phony. But to be able to demonstrate that. For instance, I managed to convince somebody to take me in Moscow to one of these Communist Party special stores that normal people had no access to in a time of shortages of meat and butter and everything else. He said, okay, you'll come with me. I'll give you this little coupon which gives you the right to the store. Don't say a word. You speak Russian, but they'll immediately know by your accent you're not a Russian. You got to act as if, you know, this is your normal shopping place. And so I did. And just that, you know, we went in very shortly and he quickly sort of pushed me out to make sure nobody got suspicious. But those kinds of glimpses of life behind the scenes were difficult, but when you got them were particularly satisfying.
A lot of your foreign correspondent work in the early years took place in a different world of technology. John Sheehan from CBS News, who covered Eastern Europe, told me once that 85 or 90% of his job was figuring out how to send the story back to the States. Do you regret those old days when you had more independence?
Yeah, I love modern technology and, you know, working on longer articles, books, so forth. It's great to be able to Google something and immediately get the background information. And I love being able to not have to worry about how to transmit information and to cut and paste and all that. But there was the early days did have the advantage that since your desk could not be in continual touch with you, when you wanted to go to many places, you were out of touch. It meant you really had the freedom to roam around and you didn't feel the barrage of pressure to be doing seven things at once. You could really focus on getting an in-depth feature story, doing all the things you needed to do for that. Now it's hard to do that because you always have competing demands. You have, say, if you're a magazine reporter, you're also writing for the website, the same thing for newspaper reporters. So you become, you know, you're pulled and pushed in various directions, and that offers you new opportunities in terms of getting new outlets for your reporting, but it also sometimes stretches you so thin that you don't get to do as much of that kind of in-depth reporting that you did before.
I want to talk a little bit about the book that you've recently published, but there's one other area that I think would be interesting to some listeners before we get there. You're associated with international editions of Newsweek, including those in other languages. Can you explain how those work?
Back 20 years ago, a Japanese publisher suggested to us that there might be a market for a Japanese language edition of Newsweek. And this was before I ever became involved in this part of our operation. And so that was launched. It did quite well. And a few more editions were added. And these are partnerships with other with foreign publishers. We give the license for the magazine, but we then have we help train the staff and then have oversight, and we watch very carefully to make sure that certain journalistic standards are maintained and that we're – because it's going out under our name, of course. But in recent years, we've accelerated that trend. When I came back to the States after being a foreign correspondent, that became my primary job, developing new foreign language editions and working with the old ones. And our most successful one happens to be in Poland, which I helped launch, which was a natural fit, of course, because I could work very closely with the editors there. And then we have one in Russia. Despite all the press controls now, so far, knock on wood, we've managed to continue publishing. We have an Arabic language edition, a Spanish language edition for Latin America, and so forth. And these are hybrids in a sense. They take some of our stories and translate them. But the newer ones especially have their own staffs that produce their own stories from a Polish or Russian or Latin American perspective. And there's that sense that this is a magazine that offers both a bit of the world that may not be accessible as well covered in the local press, but also does good job in local coverage. And that's been one area of our operations in a time when magazine operations are struggling in much of the country and the world, that seems to be still expanding. And it's been really an interesting experience for me.
Some people would say, well, actually, doesn't the Newsweek International edition reach the same kinds of people because so many of the elites abroad know English these days?
Well, what we find is that Newsweek International, as you say, reach elites. Not everybody is comfortable reading English as a second language, you know, with that kind of – it's a workout for a lot of people. And that having a magazine that both is in the language of that country but also offers far more coverage of the local politics, economics, and culture is a much stronger product. It will sell much more than Newsweek International can in English. Interestingly enough, Newsweek International sales have not gone down. In fact, when we have a strong local language edition, it sort of raises the profile of Newsweek. So both the English language edition and the local language edition seems to sort of feed off each other and get more readers.
Let's turn then to we've mentioned one of the books already when you were expelled from Moscow. Your two most recent books deal with World War II. Now, you mentioned earlier about your family's – your father's experience during World War II. Is there something else about World War II that particularly interests you?
Well, I think actually my – previous book, before The Greatest Battle, was a historical novel, and I lived in Germany twice as a correspondent. And again, this whole issue of whether history is inevitable, how things come out, fascinated me. And that historical novel is not so much about World War II, but about the rise of Hitler in the 20s. It's been endlessly written about, and there have been great the serious histories, biographies of Hitler and of the early Nazi movement. I didn't feel I could compete with that, but I did feel I could draw upon that research and also explore some lesser known aspects of Hitler's early career and relationships to do a novel that was part historical novel and part a what-if fantasy of how things could have turned out differently. Again, from a very purely personal point of view, if Hitler had been stopped, how the world would have looked differently. I don't pretend to spell all that out in the novel, but at least suggest a way of thinking about the world and about history. And I think it also implies something about the present, that there's nothing inevitable about the course of events in the present.
It's an interesting approach, though, because both journalists and historians normally avoid the what-if questions.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, in my current book, The Greatest Battle, I don't go into that in great detail, but there's also the what-if question about the battle for Moscow. What if the Germans had taken Moscow?
One final question before we turn to The Greatest Battle in more detail. In Last Stop Vienna, which is the name of the novel, it's fiction. Do you find that difficult to write?
It was difficult, but in some ways, but it was also an adventure to try it. And I started it one way maybe I made that transition was by researching it the way I would a nonfiction book at first, the period, the 20s, the early Nazi movement, the people in Hitler's entourage, his relationship with his niece, which is something I go into. And then using that as the basis for a novel where, of course, my main character is a fictional character, but he moves among real people, real events, and then, of course, the events move from real events to, you know, sort of the novelistic version of events. I'd always been tempted by that. I guess a lot of journalists are, and it sort of allows you to play and explore psychology of people and the social and try to talk about how is it possible that someone like Hitler could have come to power?
This newest book, The Greatest Battle, subtitled Stalin, Hitler, and the Desperate Struggle for Moscow that Changed the Course of World War II, I suppose a lot of listeners are pretty much unaware of the Battle for Moscow. If you think about Ken Burns' series on the war, a 7-part series, as I recall, there are maybe 5 or 6 brief mentions of the war on the Eastern Front. Can you outline perhaps briefly what this battle was all about?
Sure. I mean, in Ken Burns' series, I think, which was an excellent series, they mentioned the fact that the U.S., I think, lost 300,000 troops in combat in World War II, maybe 400,000 total non-combat. And in no way to minimize that and no way to minimize the U.S. role, but just to put it in perspective, here Hitler invades the Soviet Union in June of 1941. And the battle I'm describing, the first big, really big confrontation after Hitler sort of rolls through the Western Soviet Union, is to seize Moscow. And Hitler and Stalin see this as the decisive battle. Yeah, this is going to determine the course of the war. Moscow, after all, is the communications hub. It's the transportation hub. It's the political capital. All these things it wasn't, for instance, when Napoleon had taken Moscow in 1812. And during this battle, which lasted a little over 6 months, about 200 days, 7 million troops are involved. It's staggering to think about that. 7 million troops combined, German and Soviet. Of those, 2.5 million are what are called lost, either killed outright, taken prisoner, which in those days, taken prisoner by either side was basically amounted to a death sentence because you would either starve to death or be killed. Or missing, again, usually meant dead, or severely wounded. And what's interesting here is also that of those, even though eventually Moscow holds out just barely for reasons we can get into and I discuss in great length in the book, of those 2.5 million losses, almost 2 million are on the Soviet side. So Stalin commits colossal mistakes. Hitler commits colossal mistakes, and Moscow barely hangs on.
It's almost depressing to read about certain parts of that battle. Some of the soldiers on the Soviet side going into battle without weapons. Soldiers on the Nazi side, as the fall wore on, without proper clothing.
Yeah. I mean it is staggering. Of course, both tyrants, Stalin and Hitler, the last thing that they really cared about was their men. You know, people were expendable. But particularly for Stalin, where he had a larger reservoir of manpower, that was the philosophy. But Stalin had made the colossal mistake of ignoring all the warnings that the Germans were about to invade. Remember, Stalin and Hitler had made a pact in 1939, so they were theoretically allies. But his spies all across Europe were telling him the Germans are going to invade. The U.S. government, the British government was telling him they were going to invade. They were picking up this intelligence. Stalin refused to believe it. He was always more paranoid than seemed possible, and he thought this was all a plot to trick him to get into the war. So as a result, he didn't allow his troops to prepare for battle. Many weapon supplies were close to the frontier. So when the Germans just sort of rolled over the Soviet troops in those early days and surrounded or killed, captured or killed so many, they also got a great deal of the weapon supplies. So I found eyewitness testimonies. I interviewed many veterans who would say in those early battles they would be sent out. And you might be sent out and there might be one rifle for 10 soldiers. And you were sent – if you were one of those 9 soldiers who didn't have a rifle, they told you, go out, follow the guy with the gun. Once he falls, if you're still alive, pick up that gun. It's terrifying. And then Hitler on his part was so confident of a quick victory that he invades in late June and doesn't make any provisions for winter uniforms. So when the battle drags on much longer than they anticipated, then, of course, German soldiers begin freezing. Then the Russian winters started really – Russian winters are, of course, famous for their brutality. But that year, by October, temperatures were already plummeting and it was agony.
Now, for the general audience, I suspect the Battle of Moscow is less well known. We know about the siege at Leningrad, Harrison Salisbury's famous book about the 900 days. The wartime publicity in the United States talked a lot about the Battle of Stalingrad. Why not Moscow, considering it was the largest battle?
Yes. And you'd think that the Soviets would have, for all of their mistakes during this battle, trumpeted the battle for Moscow. And this was a question, you know, having lived in Moscow twice, by the way, I went back there as a correspondent in the mid-90s, I thought I generally knew the story until I started really digging into this story, doing research, interviewing people. I realized I knew only a fraction of what really happened. And it's not only in the United States that people know little about this. Even many Russians don't know nearly as much. And I began to ask that question to myself. And as I got into the story and the events I describe in the book, I began to understand why. Because of all these reasons that this battle, even though it was the first time the German army was stopped, remember they had marched all across Europe, occupied all of Europe except for Great Britain, and so it should have been hailed as this triumph. Well, it was at such a cost, part of it because of all these mistakes Stalin made, and also there's this great mythology about the Soviet Union and the war against Hitler that from the very beginning, everybody was united, everybody believed in victory. This battle, everything I discovered in, say, secret documents from the NKVD, the old secret police, as the KGB was then called, showed that there were a huge number of people who, first of all, soldiers who surrendered rather than in the initial phases before they realized how dangerous it was to surrender to the Germans, and civilians who doubted victory. And when the Germans actually got to the outskirts of Moscow and it looked like it was going to fall, the city was being – the government was being evacuated, the foreign embassies, the foreign correspondents, and so many factories, there was panic in the city. There was looting. There were strikes. People attack some of the government officials who were escaping. This is, you know, simply a scene. These are scenes which are unimaginable in Stalin's Soviet Union. So, you know, eventually, where Stalin declared martial law, killed a lot more of his own people. You know, he conducted the terror against his own people, even as the war was continuing. But there are so many things about this battle that make the Soviet side and version of events that undermine the Soviet propaganda about the war that they prefer to just sort of quickly mention it and move on and talked about the more decisive victory at Stalingrad where those mistakes were less evident or just the human tragedy of Leningrad. But the fact that 2.5 million troops were lost, 2 million on the Soviet side during the battle for Moscow gets short shrift. It's amazing because this is the biggest battle not just of World War II but of all time.
One quick final question since we're almost out of time. What do you hope you have accomplished with writing this book?
Well, I hope that in some way I've given a more complex view of the Soviet side of the war, of Stalin. You know, right now, under Putin, there's sort of a resurrection of Stalin, the myths about Stalin. A teacher's manual says Stalin was the greatest Soviet leader ever. That's terrifying. Not just because that's based on, they'll say, oh, he made some mistakes, he was brutal in some ways. Well, but it's mainly based on, say, he led us to victory in World War II. Well, what my book, I hope, shows is that he almost led his country to defeat in World War II in those early days. And that is a message that needs to be, I think, understood to put Stalin's role in proper perspective and also to give credit to the genuine sacrifice of so many people who were his victims, both directly and indirectly.
That brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been Andrew Nagorsky, senior editor of Newsweek International and author of the recently published The Greatest Battle. Andy, thanks for visiting.
Thank you very much.
We close with more music that Andy has chosen, Revolution by the Beatles. To our listeners, we're pleased you joined us, and we invite you to join us again next week at this time for another edition of Profiles. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
Evolution, where
The program you just heard was recorded in October of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.